This is Jared Schreiber, author of Breakout Brands, Why Some Brands Take Off and Others Don't. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Jared Schreiber to talk about his book, Breakout Brands, Why Some Brands Take Off and Others Don't, published by Javelin Press. Since graduating from MIT's Engineering Systems Division, Jared Schreiber has been rethinking how brands harness consumer data to drive growth. He was the founding CEO of Numerator, and is the former head of products and services at Retail Solutions, two successful startups that have shaped how brands better understand their consumers and win at retail in the 21st century. He also co-founded the Pat Tillman Foundation and recently established the Revolution Robotics Foundation to bring the inspirational joy of educational and competitive robotics to all kids globally. And, interesting fact, he lives in Budapest, Hungary, and in college, he was ranked fifth nationally in the javelin on the Arizona State varsity track and field team. Jared!
Oh, I love that song.
Congratulations on Breakout Brands, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. Great to be here. And boy, it's been a while since I've heard that marching band song.
Yeah, back to your day. Now, you're from Arizona originally, right?
I am, actually, indeed. Yeah.
So, before we go any further, though, tell listeners about the Pat Tillman, about him and the Pat Tillman Foundation.
Boy, I think we could do a podcast on that, and it still wouldn't be enough.
Well, and I got to say, as a U.S. Army veteran, I hear Pat Tillman, and it really, really means a lot to me. So, please tell all the other folks about him. Perhaps a lot of people who don't follow the NFL or who sure. are from Arizona know about him, but then also what the foundation does.
Absolutely. Pat Tillman was a standout football player at Arizona State University when they had their undefeated regular season back in the late 90s, and went on to the NFL, four-year career, and was really outstanding. And when September 11th, 2001 happened, he was a few years into his NFL career and just decided that he'd had it pretty easy, and he didn't think it was right that the only people who went to kind of defend our rights and freedoms as Americans tended to come from tougher backgrounds. And so he stood up and said, I'll enlist. And unfortunately, a few years later, he was killed in a friendly fire incident in Afghanistan. And mm-hmm. so
and he was a Ranger.
He was a Ranger. And more than that, he was the most amazing human being I have ever known in my life. I had the great privilege of getting to know him in our days together as Sun Devils, as student athletes, and then as friends during his years in the NFL. And after his death, his family asked me to help them set up the Pat Tillman Foundation, and honored to have done so.
And what kind of things does the Pat Tillman Foundation do?
The Pat Tillman Foundation provides scholarships to returning military veterans and their spouses to pursue higher education. If you think of it a little bit like the GI Bill and how transformative that was for America after World War II and in the 50s, Pat Tillman Foundation is doing that for master's and PhD level. So basically the best of the best having an opportunity to have the greatest impact on society and helping them pursue higher level degrees, master's, PhDs, et cetera.
Wonderful. And the stadium there is named after him now, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, on to your book. You know, this, for me, reading it was like reading Good to Great, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. or you know, it was like a CEB book, like Challenger Sale or Challenger Customer, or even Matt Dixon's new book, The Jolt Effect. He was one of the authors of those Challenger books. It's because all of those books have so much data behind them. So there were certain things that surprised me, but then you had all this data behind it. It's like, oh, this guy's not just making it up like some authors. And it's just amazing. This book's going to be around for a long time. And I think it's going to rewire a lot of marketing brains. And I think it's going to piss off a lot of people or frighten a lot of marketers.
I hope all the above are true.
Right, right. So, but I really liked it, or as Borat would say,
wah, wah, wee, wah.
So just to set the stage here for folks and give them a little sample of it from the intro, you write, leading brand marketing experts have long held that brands grow by getting more people to buy their products or by getting existing customers to spend even more on the product. In their mind, it's all about acquisition and loyalty. We're told that brands grow by luring in more one-time light buyers, or that brands grow by winning their customers' devotion and unwavering loyalty. We've been sold on so-called laws of marketing, which lead us to believe that to grow, brands must be distinctive, not differentiated, and must continuously reach all buyers of the category, especially via mass media advertising. The problem is that these hidebound ideas rely on incomplete or one-dimensional data that doesn't paint a full picture of how brands really grow. One study will be based on advertising data and show how advertising affects brand growth. Another will examine pricing and show how price elasticity shapes your brand's sales. Another study will examine how promotions drive immediate sales lift without considering any longer-term side effects. No one has been able to integrate all this data to conduct a long-term study. No one has ever explained how these factors work together to dictate how brands perform. The result is a lot of confusion. There is no clear framework or principles for brand managers to follow. We treat brand marketing like a simple structure built upon the pillars of product, price, place, and promotion. But our study revealed brand building is a very complex, nonlinear system full of feedback loops. And then you go on to write, and I was especially excited about this section because three of these four people I've had the honor of interviewing. There's no shortage of theories about why brands win. A brand manager might pull from the work of Philip Kotler and David Ocker, or contemporary thought leaders like Byron Sharp and Peter Fader, only to find their practical implications in direct conflict. And then you go on to write, there has to be a way out of this maze. So, as I mentioned earlier, you write in the intro that this book is to brand management what Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, was for company management. Explain.
Absolutely. So, look, the questions there and the conundrums faced that I lay out in the beginning are the same conundrums that I was facing as an advisor to almost every major consumer brand in the world building Numerator, where they were coming to me asking questions, and I was no longer sure as to which of these kind of theories or methodologies held true because I found them in conflict. And that's exactly why I went off to do this research and use the data to actually guide what is true. What can we truly understand about the drivers of brand growth? And is it about acquisition? And is it about light buyers? Or is it about loyalty? What does the data actually say, studying 25,000 brands over 5 years to understand what really drove the growth? So it was my own personal questions reflected there that I set out to study. I didn't have a particular thesis going in as to which perspective was the right one, or that I was trying to prove any particular one. I just felt like my clients, the Nestle's, the Procter & Gamble's, the other companies, all had conflicting views in terms of how to grow a brand, and they couldn't all be true. They were mutually exclusive. And so more research needed to be done to understand the fundamental principles that could guide the science of marketing rather than continuing as just an art.
Now, in case somebody missed it, 25,000 brands, and as I understand it, 58 broke out. So you went back and looked at, all right, what did those 58 have in common? And that is what's so amazing about the book. But just back up one more time, explain how you collected that data, because it was a new way that was easier for consumers to share that information.
That's exactly right. So when marketing science came about as a discipline, really in the 1950s, was with the advent of the consumer purchase diary, where consumers were asked to write down what they were purchasing. That evolved into barcode scanning as that technology became available. And that continued from the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, into the 2000s, where you had these barcode scanners in people's homes. And they were asked to scan every product that they bought. And of course, you know, it's just a really clunky experience and not that many people are willing to do it and do it consistently. And with the advent of smartphones, just realized that we could appify and gamify the experience for consumers to report their purchase activity all the way down to making it as simple as just taking a picture of their receipt. So everywhere they shopped, no matter where they shopped, no matter what they bought, simply take a picture of the receipt in our gamified apps and they would earn a reward and we would get the data on all of their purchases, the prices they paid, whether it was on promotion or not, et cetera. And that became the basis of what is now today Numerator. And as we grew, we added additional capabilities, the ability to trigger surveys to consumers immediately upon purchase or after a set of purchase behaviors over time. We started collecting advertising on every media channel, 22 different types of media from TV and radio and print to social and digital, every ad placed and understanding what brands are advertising, how much, via what channels. Every promotion in every store, what type of promotion, what products were involved, every price, and then every e-commerce site, scraping every single e-commerce site consistently to understand what products were available at what price and what kind of reviews they were getting and what the contents of those reviews were. And so at Numerator, we amassed a data set, a comprehensive data set, the likes of which had just never existed before and never been unified before. And that provided the baseline by which we could do a more strategic and comprehensive study of how brands break out and really grow.
You had me at 25,000 brands and 58 broke out. It was like, okay, I can't stop reading because what happened? So one thing I need to mention, Jared, is I have to go on an errand right now. I need to get to the wine store before it closes. So I'm going to ask you two questions from page 13 in the introduction.
All right.
And then come back in about 45 minutes and see how you're doing. And those two questions, this could be the entire interview. What had these winning brands done to separate themselves from the pack? And likewise, why had some of their prominent competitors slipped? I'm kidding. I'm not going to the wine store. I got plenty of time. But
this was shocking to me.
What's that?
I mean, just the simple, what is the threshold for a brand to be a breakout brand?
Yes.
And demonstrate significant growth? We've got 25,000 consumer goods brands in America. What does it mean to have a good year and a good few years and really be in the top, you know, Olympic level elite performance of brands in terms of growth? The bar, the threshold is so low, I couldn't have even imagined it before I set out for this study.
There is going to be so much head slapping by readers.
Growing 0.5% of market share per year for 3 years puts you in the top, you know, 1/1000th of brands is unbelievable. I mean, that should be every brand manager's objective by which they are measured and bonused every single year. And yet only a tiny sliver fraction of brands are actually able to attain that. So the threshold that we ended up setting to pick these 58 brands was as simple as, could they grow market share in their category by at least 0.5% a year for 3 years? And could they grow US retail sales by at least $10 million a year for that period? So over a 3 year period, a 1.5% market share gain and a $30 million US retail sales gain was the threshold. And out of 25,000 brands, only 58 met that criteria.
Did you initially think there would be more than 58?
Well, I didn't start with that in mind. I mean, I thought we were looking for brands that were growing 30 million a year and growing market share by 2 percentage points a year. Like I would have guessed that was the standard by which we could cut it down to just 50 or 60 brands. But that's not at all. We just had to keep lowering the standard and the barrier by which we could define what was a breakout brand. That was shocking to me.
Oh, it's like you wanted to say, come on, people, help me out here.
But I think it says something about the state of best practice. And like if best practices were known and applied by some brands, you would think that we would have a lot more brands that could consistently grow year over year. And it tells us, I think, something about the state of marketing science.
And at the end of the book, you mentioned Billy Bean, Moneyball. And I went and watched a couple of clips because I love that movie, but it had been a while since I'd seen it. And there was this one clip where, now for those folks that don't know, he became the general manager, I believe, of the Oakland Athletics years ago. And he didn't have a lot of money and he had to figure out, and he did it with the help of a young Yale graduate who was really a quantitative guy, had studied economics. And they started to look at the data. They were sort of Jared Schreiber before there was Jared Schreiber on the scene here. And as I recall, they realized it wasn't about home runs, it wasn't RBIs, it wasn't, you know, batting average. The most important number was like on base percentage. And they started looking for that and they did really well. And so there's a scene in the movie where he's sitting down with these kind of old time baseball scouts and they want to find, they think they know how to do it, right? And he's saying, no, guys, there's some data. We're gonna use these numbers. And I just thought that was such a great analogy for this book where you're saying, you know what? There's a lot of bad advice out there based on your study. And we're gonna talk about that. And as I said earlier, the book just blew my mind. And there are so many interesting things to ask you about. But because of that, and because I want to respect the listener's time, I'm gonna have to do something that is a real challenge for me, Jared, which is to show some restraint and hit just a few of the biggest takeaways from this book. But honestly, if you are a brand marketer and you have not read this book, you are in trouble. And I think I was just thinking like from the board standpoint, I would want everybody in the marketing department of a, you know, let's say a consumer packaged good, if that's not too niche. You need to read that book and let me know what changes we're going to be making. I'm not overstating that. So in the beginning of the book, you say, look, this is what's ahead. And there's like eight really key points. And then at the end of each chapter, you say, again, these are the key takeaways. And the way it's written is really well paced and it wasn't too dense. And then at the end, you've got chapter 12, I think it is, where you say, all right, I know this is overwhelming. These are the eight things you need to go do right now. Right. But it was really very clear. It wasn't surprising. So let's go through some of these things. I've tried to pull out just some of the really, really big points here and ask you to talk about it. So let's go. I'm kind of going to go in order here. But
sure.
And again, some of these things made sense and I knew about it. I mean, years and years ago, I was an ad man in Madison Avenue in New York and working on ads for companies like products like Listerine mouthwash or, you know, various toothpaste or razor blades, all this kind of thing. So I was really familiar with a lot of this. And some of the things I remember we did and the clients did that made perfect sense here and others, big mistake, big misunderstanding. So the first one is, and again, this is a book that might upset a lot of people. Some of you may actually stop listening when you hear some of this if you've, you know, sort of tethered your career to some of these beliefs that you've had. So the first one is winning among particular demographics doesn't matter as much as many brand managers believe.
Exactly. Case in point would have been a winning brand such as Modelo. Modelo's what's generally classified as a Mexican beer. Of course, it outperformed among Hispanics and Latinos in America relative to how it performed in other demographics. But unlike some other brands, it didn't decide, well, we're just going to be a Mexican beer and we're going to target all of our messaging and advertising and communications towards Hispanics and Latinos. Instead, they did everything they could to broaden their appeal across the full spectrum of demographics in America, in terms of who they were showing, in what kinds of situations and contexts, and who they were featuring, their sampling, other things that they did to reach every type of beer consumer there was. And the key finding is winning brands, as they grow, close their affinity gaps. If they don't have a high affinity among African Americans, if they don't have a high affinity under lower income households, if they don't have a strong affinity, they work to close those gaps. They don't simply double down on where they're already strong, because if they do that, they're going to stay niche and they're just not going to break out with growth.
Mm. And another example, I think, is where you talk about Mission versus Guerrero, yes. Where exactly. Guerrero was very focused on the Hispanic market, and Mission, I guess, was as well, but they didn't stop there.
That's exactly right. I think I give examples from their websites in terms of how they position themselves, from their packaging, the use of Spanish language on packaging for Guerrero, but Mission being in English. On the website, Mission provides recipes that use soft tacos, tortillas, for all kinds of dishes, you know, anything from something that you would consider more Greek or all American in nature versus Hispanic. Guerrero was focused on being authentic Mexico and Mexican food. And what happened is, even though the Hispanic market in America was growing significantly, yes, Guerrero grew in sales, but they lost in market share. And they lost in particular to Mission, who was just reaching the fullness of people who bought that category, which of course expands and extends well beyond the Hispanic population. And in doing so, Mission experienced true breakout growth.
So two other things from this I want to ask about is, explain why winning brands appeal more to people who normally don't buy the product category, which may seem counterintuitive.
It really is counterintuitive. You would, and for one, I just want to clarify. I mean, the breakout brands appeal most to the heaviest buyers of the category.
Right.
One of the side effects of that is that as there are new entrants to the product category, as people buy for the first time, they become disproportionately more likely to buy a successful breakout brand than any other brand. So these breakout brands win more than their fair share of new category entrants, is the way to put it. And why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One is, quite often, people are new to a category, refer to others. And so they go, who else uses this product? Well, nowadays, that's often online reviews. What product's getting outstanding reviews, for example? And they'll give that one a try. Another one might be asking a friend who they know is a heavy user. You know, they've got lots of dogs, and you want to know what flea collar to use or pet food. And so you ask your friend who has a lot of dogs, who's the heavy user, because they probably know the products in the category best. And so there are a number of reasons for this, but you can tell you're on the right track as a brand if you are getting more than your fair share of new buyers of the category.
And this is where it gets a little controversial, because throughout the book, you talk about Ehrenberg Bass, Byron mm-hmm. Sharp, and I assume it's because they are so well, that body of work is so well known.
They have been the most influential thought leaders, if I can say that, in the consumer goods industry in the last 10 to 15 years in terms of shaping how to think about how to grow a brand. And quite frankly, I would have called myself a disciple of that marketing worldview as of a few years ago before I set out on this study. But the data just didn't support many of the things that they hold.
So having said that, one of the pillars of a lot of their work is that you should be focusing on picking up light users of your category. Explain why you should pay more attention to the heaviest buyers of your category, not the lightest.
Sure. So, well, for one, the heavy buyers of the category account for easily 7 times more sales or purchasing per person than the lighter category buyers. So winning one of them is worth at least 7x a lighter category buyer. Two, the heavy category buyers are the ones that dictate the direction that the category is going in. They're the ones who have the most refined requirements, the greatest demands on the category. And if they're choosing your brand over other brands, there's a really good reason for it. They're familiar with what's going on. And so what happens is, because they're driving so much volume, if they're buying your product, your product is selling more through the retailer. If you're selling more through the retailer, you're more likely to get featured more. You're more likely to get better shelf space, to get additional shelf facings. If you're bought online, you're more likely to show up first or second in product searches. Higher in rankings means you're going to get purchased more often. There are all these feedback loops that happen as a result of appealing to the heaviest buyers of the category and winning with them, that become follow-on trickle effects in terms of forms of social validation, of improved merchandising and distribution, in terms of word of mouth. All of these things flow from the heavy category buyers. They do not flow from the light category buyers. And that's a very important distinction.
Has there been any reaction or response from Byron Sharp or his organization?
Not directly, through what I would say some disciples out there. Absolutely. There have kind of been some questions related to it. But at this point, I just haven't seen any data that offers a counter perspective to that. I think what we've done is demonstrated by breaking out the behavior of high, medium, and low buyers year over year. And how their behavior changes with winning brands versus losing brands, I think we've demonstrated pretty conclusively that where the heavy category buyers go is where dictates the winners and losers within that category among competing brands.
Yes, and I don't mean for this to be turning into some sort of celebrity death match here between you and Byron Sharp. They like data, you know. I'm sure they're
absolutely
very interested in this, and they've said they've done a lot of things right, and they've had,
yes,
know, like you said, you were a disciple of theirs, more or less. Let's jump ahead. I realize this may sound like a high school essay question, Jared, but compare and contrast usage occasions and jobs to be done as it relates to breakout brands.
You got it. So, one, I found Clayton Christensen's work on jobs to be done to be fundamentally insightful and valuable in terms of understanding what was happening with the brands that were breakout winners versus the brands that were declining and losing. Their ability to excel at particular jobs to be done was critical. An example would be something like Bang Energy Drink. So in the energy drink market, Bang focused itself on being kind of a healthier alternative with nutrients and supplements and less sugar. And so as a result, if the job to be done was, I need to go exercise, I need to go work out, but I need a boost, I need an energy boost. Well, traditional energy drinks were too full of sugar, for example, to appeal to people who care about their fitness but want an energy boost before a workout. Bang really focused its positioning, its messaging, its use of social media influencers around people who were fit, who were working out, and were looking for that extra energy around that. So that was the job to be done. The job to be done was, I want to stay fit, or I want to work out, but I don't want all these calories, but I do want the energy. Give me an energy drink that meets that. And so that ties to a specific type of usage occasion. If you understand the job to be done and you can deliver in the actual occasion of usage to consumers in a way that existing products in the category fall short, you're onto something.
Okay, so targeting a demographic, which we've just covered, a lot of brands are still doing that. Explain how that's different from what a usage occasion is, which is really
sure,
regardless of the demographic, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So exactly, regardless of the demographic, I think demographic marketing is a lot like identity politics, and it's a dead end road, right?
Yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah,
that is not a path to win and succeed. Instead, focus very much on the types of usage occasions that consumers have for your type of product.
Like working out.
Working out, staying fit. An example with Reese's, which was a breakout brand, is they realized people want to eat Reese's maybe on the go or without the ability to use two hands at the same time, which means they don't want to have to unwrap each and every Reese's piece in order to eat it. And so they launched the Reese's Minis with this resealable bag where you pop open the bag, it stays open, you can reach a hand into it, grab a Reese's Mini and throw it in your mouth without having to unwrap each individual one. And that was one of the most successful product launches in the last decade. They understood a particular type of usage occasion. The usage occasion was on the go or distracted. I don't have both hands to dedicate towards this task. And Reese's found a way to win on that.
And so when I read about that, I thought, oh, that's great. So you can use one hand to eat the candy. You can use one hand to scroll through your Instagram feed. And then with your knees, you can drive. Yeah. So
we should be so lucky.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm just say that to the listeners who are driving right now. Please keep your eyes on the road. I need to keep every listener I have. Now, I want to ask one question. It's a little bit in the weeds, as they say, but it's very important for those that like to measure things, particularly all those brand managers out there. Explain why it is that when you measure category sales and market share by usage occasion, it often becomes clear why a particular competitor is climbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the norm is we just look at sales to understand market share, and they're like, okay, sales are up here and there, and you know.
Well, can't you also just look at market share data from like Nielsen or some of the companies that provide
it? Sure, and that might tell you in certain retail channels, like okay, in traditional grocery versus drug stores, your share has gone up, you know, this much month to month, or a competitor has risen, but it doesn't help you really understand why. So why is it that brand is growing? You know, maybe you could tease out some price effects, maybe other things, but if there's some trends, true underlying trend, how do you get at the why? Why is that happening? And what our research showed is that why often tied back to something had changed or shifted in terms of a brand's ability to meet the needs of consumer in a particular type of occasion. I can give an extreme example, which was in the frozen desserts. And when COVID hit, people couldn't go out to restaurants as much. And so they weren't getting their desserts away from home, their pies and cakes after a meal. And so they started consuming them at home a lot more, which means they were buying these at the grocery store. And the big winner there provided a fully ready solution, and the losers were ones where you still had a lot of work to do, because while it was kind of novel to, oh, I'm going to make my own pie from scratch and I'll just use this pre-made crust and I'll do all the filling, that wore off real quick, and the ready to bake frozen pies were the winners. People wanted something quick and convenient. Jimmy Dean with their breakfast sausages, they kind of realized that consumers weren't taking the time to cook sausages up before they went out the door in the morning. And so they said, how do we package sausage inside of something like a ready-to-go microwavable burrito or sausage breakfast sandwich that's basically heat and eat within 30 seconds and is easy to consume on the go? That was understanding the usage occasion. And that explained why the brand was growing and winning share in that category, is they had done something to win a type of usage occasion.
Right. So my sense is that a lot of companies see a big shift up or down in market share and they say, well, clearly the advertising and marketing people need to be fired, but, or, you know, whatever. But it's really, they should be saying, what has happened with our usage occasion?
Yes.
And that might give them all kinds of great insights. You know, you talk about the pies and then people want the pies to be easier. And I just keep going back to opening up that bag of Reese's. You can literally pour them into your mouth. Not that I've been doing research leading up to this interview, but this next thing I want to ask you about is something that, honestly, to quote the Zoolander guys, I feel like I've been taking crazy pills for my whole career. And there have been books and studies that back this up. And it warmed the cockles of my heart when your study proved this. So talk about what your study revealed and confirmed about why emotions at the subconscious level, not rational thought, looking at you B2B people, why emotions at the subconscious level, not rational thought, drive purchase decisions.
Oh boy. Well, we could talk for an hour on this topic.
Yeah, I may go to the grocery store now. Yeah.
Well, let's do that. Let's do that with your listeners, everybody. Guess what? You've got to do your weekly stock up trip at the grocery store, and you want to be quick, and you got to pick up 15, 20, 30 items, and you want to just get into the store, get the things you need, and get home. My question to you is, honestly, be honest with yourself. How much time do you spend evaluating which specific product in a category is the best purchase for you to make on that occasion right then and there to put in your basket? Are you comparing the labels and the ingredients? Are you really focused on price per ounce or something like that? Or are you basically seeing something, a product you're familiar with, something that looks good enough, that'll meet the need, and you throw it in your basket and you move on? And what we know from our research over many years now is that the vast majority of decisions in fast-moving consumer goods are very reflexive. Consumers are satisfying. It means as soon as they see something that's good enough based on some rough cut heuristic criteria, it's in. And so what then nudges them to choose any one product over another? Well, what we've learned, from like Daniel Kahneman and the behavioral economists and a lot of the neuroscientists, is there's a priming effect that can take place in the brain between system one and system two thinking, and that this reflexive emotional based decision kind of primes what we're going to choose much more than the hard effort of rationally thinking through what is the best choice. And therefore, anything that reflexively ties to your emotional feeling is going to win out over something that requires hard, concentrated thought to make a rational choice.
Yes, and it came to mind this week when I went on Amazon I needed to buy some insect repellent. It's getting to be mosquito season here in Virginia. And I had this app or this Chrome plugin from Consumer Reports, and I had forgotten that I'd installed it. So I was on the Amazon page looking at the kind I wanted to buy. It's what I'd already had, I liked. And this little message came up saying, oh, that's a 25. These are much better. And so I thought, oh, well, let me look at those. They have more teeth. They last longer. It's like, I didn't care. I ended up buying the one that's less effective, but I liked it because I've used it, never had a problem. So yeah, it's a perfect example.
It's good enough.
Exactly. Satisficing.
In the moment, it seemed good enough, and you've got 20 other decisions to make still on that shopping trip, and so you just aren't going to invest the time and energy to figure out if that's really the best choice at that moment.
Yes. So years ago, I was working on this one brand in New York called Brill Cream, which was a really old brand. In fact, it had been bought by another company that bought old brands. Brill Cream, a little dab will do you. And they were introducing Brill Cream hair gel, which was, so anyway, I remember talking to the product manager one day, and I said, how is this going to be priced? And he said, oh, it's going to be priced to sell, very aggressively priced. And I remember thinking to myself, why is he talking to us, the ad agency, why do you even need what we're going to be doing? And there were some things that we could be doing, but you make it abundantly clear in your book that losing brands often resorted to price-based competition. Talk about what your research revealed about promotional pricing.
Ooh,
I know almost sounds like a don't do drugs kid
please
section,
please. If we could get that into our colleagues' mind in the industry, that promotions are like a drug.
Yeah,
they give you a short positive hit, but they do have long-term cumulative consequences for your brand. I think that would be one of the best takeaways from
this. Is your brand this is your brand on drugs
and on drugs yeah. That's exactly it.
Go ahead.
And it is just really shameful that we in the industry have not woken up to this and really understand and done something about it. So there are two reasons why competing on price is a losing strategy. One is, in general, even with everyday low pricing, private label is going to win that game. fundamentally, if you want to compete on price, you are competing against private label. And how do you do that as a national brand? That is a losing strategy. And many, many of our losing brands in each category were brands that were the everyday low price leaders. Furthermore, brands that start, you know, they're trying to grow faster or they're trying to hemorrhage losses, they're trying to do something, start resorting to trade promotions, right? To work with and through the retailers to cut prices and feature their product on cut prices. And so, of course, they get a sales boost for that week or 2 weeks that they're on promotion. And then the next week, they don't see any decline. So they think, oh, it worked. Like all of those incremental sales were truly incremental to business. But what they don't take into account is those people who just bought on promotion, what do they do next time that they go to buy? And some of them are going to buy again in 2 weeks, and some in 4 weeks, and some in 7 weeks, and some may never again. That is what matters, because in fast-moving consumer goods, you know, 90% of your sales are from people who have already bought the brand previously, or at least the category previously. It's repeat purchase behavior that actually dictates your overall trends in terms of growth. And what we find is if you sell it to somebody on a discount now, the next time that they go to make a purchase decision, you have primed them to look for a lower price on that product. And if they don't get it, now all of a sudden they don't think they're getting as good a value or a bargain anymore. And it makes them actually more likely than they otherwise would have been to switch away from your brand the next time they go to make a purchase. Mm-hmm. And this is really important. And the only way that you can tease this out is to look at consecutive repeat purchase rates, which is not a metric that anybody's been looking at for 60, 70 years now, but it turns out to be fundamentally critical to understand why brands grow and why they decline. And if you really want to understand if your trade promotions drive incrementality, you can only do that by looking at how consumer repeat purchase rate plays out as a result of that promotion that you ran.
Yes. And now you do talk about some pricing where it could be, you know, buy one, get the other one half price, but you're mm-hmm. not telling people, you're not subconsciously telling them what your product's really worth.
That's exactly right. So to the extent you are going to run trade promotions, disguise the pricing, mask the pricing. Don't do it in a way so it's so clear and obvious to them that they've just paid $1 per package for your product. You know, if they start thinking of that as the value of your product, you are really damaging the value of your brand and its ability to capture sales at full price ongoing. So to the extent you are going to do trade promotions, do clever programs where, you know, it's buy three, get one free, or buy two, get one half off, or other kinds of things where people in their minds can't comprehend what that actually is on a price basis. Oh, it looks like a good deal. Okay. That's probably the best you can do.
Yes.
And the other thing is trade promotions, when you're launching a new product and you're trying to drive initial trial, okay, that's a different story. To get that first purchase for a consumer to actually try your product and see if they really like it, that's a very different story than doing this with more established products and brands.
Well, and you also talk about how sampling can be enormously effective, and you're not necessarily discounting then. You're just giving it away free the first time.
Exactly. Free is discontinuous versus a price.
Yes.
A price of zero is not a price. It's not thought of in that regard, and especially if it's a gift or other things, it can actually come with positive benefits and occasions. I remember I did a Tough Mudder race early in the days of InfoScout Numerator with some colleagues, and at the end of the race, you know, of course, we're sweaty messes, and in part of our care pack that we got as we finished, we got some Degree deodorant for men, and I'd never even considered trying Degree, but of course, I was going to use it right then and there, and I actually thought it was a great product, and I started buying it religiously after that. It became, you know, the only deodorant I would buy, and it was all because I had gotten that sample at a moment where I kind of needed it. I used it, tried it, loved the product, had a great experience, and decided that that's what I was going to use ongoing. And I think sampling is often underutilized. Modelo, for example, used this really well. Health Aid Kombucha, one of the winning brands, used a lot of sampling to help fuel their growth. If you've got a great product that really delivers, get it into the hands of consumers to try it. And if they love it, they will buy it ongoing.
Right. So the next thing I want to ask you about, I think it's going to upset everyone who works in advertising and everyone who sells advertising and all kinds of things like that. And this was a big one. This was a big one. If you can pull just one lever to drive brand growth, choose the distribution lever.
Yes.
Please explain.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, by the way, don't trust me. If you work for a big consumer goods company or brand, go to your forecasting department. Go to the people whose job it is to work with finance and production to forecast and ask them what are the variables that go into their models to figure out what growth or decline is going to happen in the next year. Ask them what the inputs to that model are and how much those inputs are weighted. And guess what they're going to tell you? Changes in distribution, a la ACV, all commodity volume, or PCV, are going to be weighted often at 80 to 90% of the projection impact of change in sales. So you don't have to trust me. It just turns out that in the data, when we looked at all the different variables that could have been explaining changes in sales of these breakout brands to the positive and the breakout brands to the negative, the losers, when we tried to say, you know, what's influencing this? It was clear and compelling that changes in retail distribution were explaining up to 85% of the year-over-year changes in sales in the positive, you know, for expanded distribution leading to growth and declining distribution leading to loss. Whereas when we looked at changes in advertising spend, we found very, very small, you know, correlations and potential causal impact of changes in advertising spend as a result. Of course, a great campaign executed well with great reach is going to have an impact. I'm not suggesting otherwise. What I'm saying is we looked at 25,000 brands. We found 58 that really broke out year over year. And if you wanted to explain the one thing that fundamentally changed their sales trajectory, year over year, distribution.
Yes, and you're very clear in the book. You are not anti-advertising, and in a few minutes we're going to talk about how advertising really can work well, particularly even television advertising. But I just want to underscore what is such an important point on page 108. You write, among our winning and losing brands, distribution explained 87% of these brands' changes in sales. And then you also referenced the head of analytics at a top 10 CPG company, who you don't identify. I see what you did there. Probably because he said, hey, this isn't coming from me. But he said, in our forecasting models, distribution carries 85% of the weight. Everything else in the marketing mix is minor in comparison. And let's not forget, you write that 80% of a category's sales happen in physical stores. So e-commerce is important, and you say it's going to be important in the future because of all the data we're going to continue to collect. But that was a really big one. So let me just jump ahead to a couple of those. And again, these are just the big points. Would you still agree that I'm hitting all the big points?
you're hitting many of the key takeaways.
Okay.
But, you know, as you noted, there were a number of things in here. It's like,
it's 300 page book. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. No. I mean, I would have kept writing for another 100 pages, but it was, I admire how you all were able to boil it down so succinctly. Again, just like the CEB people did, or Jim Collins did.
I mean, he was the model, right? Good to Great was the role model book that we were trying to say, can we do what he did for companies, do that for brands?
Yeah.
With even more data, with even more, you know, kind of structured quantitative research behind our findings.
Mm. So jumping ahead, I recently interviewed Dr. Philip Kotler for the fourth time. So he's still very much in the mix of things. He's 92 now. And he's got a few more books he's working on. So with any luck, I'll be able to interview him again. But I want to jump back to you talk about him and what he's believed and written about, and he's just one person like that. And then you talk about, again, back to the kind of the Byron Sharp camp. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that we talk about this. You're right. It's a popular assertion that differentiation doesn't matter because other brands can imitate your innovation. But your data tells a different story. Explain.
Exactly right. It's exactly right. So I didn't know what I believed going in. In fact, I had made compelling arguments years prior in favor of the Byron Sharp view that differentiation doesn't matter. It's about distinction.
Right.
But I wanted to put it to the test in the data that we had. And quite frankly, I think the single most compelling bit of evidence against that worldview and in favor of Kotler's views that differentiation is critical and core and does matter is we had continuous brand equity trackers of brands, both winners and losers over many year periods of time on 140 different metrics from Berra AI that was continuously tracking this off tens of thousands of consumers. How were they scoring the brands across tons of different attributes that contribute to brand equity? And these attributes could have been like as simple as friendliness, trustworthy, quality, many, many factors. And we took all the different factors that they had continuously tracked and we said, where did the breakout brands that were winners really differentiate themselves or score differently than the losers? On what factors? On what attributes? And out of these 140 something attributes, two jumped out way above all the others as being the biggest difference between the winning brands and the losing brands. And those two factors were the extent to which consumers considered the brand innovative and unique.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Innovative and unique. That was more important than quality and trustworthiness. And I like the brand and any other factors you could possibly imagine. Innovativeness and unique. And then furthermore, if you want to say, well, how did this brand actually grow over this period? You know, we talked about distribution. Well, how did they gain distribution or what things really changed? I gave the examples of Reese's earlier with the Reese's Minis not being wrapped anymore. Okay. Sounds like a basic innovation, but it was innovation. And what we found is so many of the winning brands had done something to differentiate their product in the market, to have an innovation. Ollie with their sleep gummies, they gave a gummy into the sleep aid category instead of a standard melatonin pill, for example. Or so many of these brands offered something that was different and differentiated and did the job better in some way that the consumer was trying to get done, that to claim that distinction is what really mattered, I think just flies directly in the face of the actual data of how did these winning brands win and why did the losing brands lose.
Mm. And that's why this is such an interesting line of work and why I love doing this podcast. It's just you keep learning more and more and more research keeps coming up. So let's jump ahead to what I think folks saw coming when I said that the distribution lever is so important. And this is one where, again, I'm sure it's going to upset it's going to upset everyone in the advertising industrial complex of which I used to be a member. You write that many experts say that growing a brand requires increasing awareness through advertising. Mm-hmm. Years ago, that mm-hmm. was the gospel. I can remember pitching mm-hmm. our businesses, awareness leads to preference, right? You probably heard that expression. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
But your winning brands did not win due to gains in awareness.
That's exactly right. That was one of the metrics tracked continuously over time across, thousands of brands by Berra. And we could track awareness and we could track, all of these different stages of the funnel. And that was not a differentiator. That was not something that scored differently for the breakout winning brands versus the losing brands. It wasn't changes in awareness at all that explained any difference in performance between the winners and losers. So I'm not saying awareness isn't important. What I'm saying is it didn't explain changes in growth and decline in these brands. The other thing I would say is, awareness doesn't just come from advertising. Awareness comes from the product being on the shelf at the store where the consumer buys that product category.
Right, back to the distribution.
It comes from distribution and merchandising. Right. And moreover, where it comes from most is actual experience using or consuming the product. I give the example of White Claw. Most people didn't try White Claw having bought it for themselves. Most people got their first trial of White Claw going to some party or event where it was one of the beverage options and they tried it.
Ain't no laws when you're drinking claws, baby.
Exactly. So you know, I think we need to fundamentally rethink what it means to build awareness for a product and not just automatically assume that, you know, any awareness gains are going to come from increases in advertising.
But it's easier to buy ads, Jared. Come on, help a brother out.
But of course it is.
Yes,
of course
yes.
It is. And I'm not saying advertising doesn't work.
No.
I just think we've overemphasized its role in building and growing a brand.
Right, but a couple chapters later, you write that most brands over-advertise, and you've got the data that proves it, and you also write, advertising is not the panacea everyone thinks it is. It can increase sales, but not as much as most brand managers think it will. My goodness. But let's talk about one thing where advertising really works well at building brand equity. That's what you talk about when touting a new innovation, which ties back to what you just mentioned about how innovation was so important. Talk about when advertising does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. So when you have a new product innovation, is an incredible time to advertise and promote the heck out of it for two reasons. Not only because you want to try and drive initial trial by making consumers aware and getting them to consider this new product of yours, but it has a halo effect on the entire brand. So basically, it makes your entire brand look innovative because you have some new product offering that does something new and shiny. It also makes advertising more effective because we know from research that as soon as you say something is new or different or improved, that all of a sudden consumers, people, humans, are going to listen and pay attention a little bit more than they otherwise would have. Mm-hmm. You know, we are wired as curiosity creatures. And we have this insatiable curiosity as human beings. And so if you know, a human hears there's something new, their ears are going to perk up and they're going to pay more attention and be more attentive to the advertising and messaging than otherwise. And so that's yet another reason. But there's so many pile-on effects from really putting your advertising efforts behind new products in a way that doesn't just improve sales in the new product, but it carries over to the entire brand.
We'll talk about how it helps with the distribution that we already talked about.
Sure. So I think this is really undervalued, is the role of advertising in gaining distribution. So one, if you've ever been a salesperson trying to sell a brand into a retailer, I can almost assure you, if it's a decent sized retailer, the buyer is asking the question. So what are you doing to advertise this product? How much advertising support is behind this product? Okay. So often in order to gain distribution, you have to have pretty decent muscle and effort behind advertising. So that's first and foremost a role of advertising in terms of contributing to distribution. But I also give the example of what I call the most valuable billboard in America.
Oh yeah.
No, it's not in Times Square. It's next to the employee parking lot of Walmart headquarters.
Yes.
Because that billboard gets seen every day by the retail buyer for that category. And so subliminally, whether they're conscious of it or not, now they're increasing awareness and interest in that brand. So when you go to sell them and say, hey, we really think you should carry this product, they're already familiar with it. Like it's as if it's something known and popular and familiar to them already. And by the way, if they were conscious of that billboard, then they go, wow, you guys must be spending a lot on advertising to have this promoted and featured here. So if you think about it, like moving the needle 1% on the likelihood of a Walmart buyer deciding to go ahead and carry and list your product in their stores is worth tens to hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes. And what is it, 50,000 people in Bentonville, I think?
Exactly.
You mentioned in the book.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the best thing you could do is buy spot television in the Bentonville area.
Probably the best money you could spend.
Yeah.
You know, spot social media, other things.
Right.
You know, around retailer headquarters where the retail buyers are. You know, absolutely.
I remember back when I was working on Madison Avenue, we would do all this television and all kinds of support. And we would also produce these little one-page storyboards of television commercials that were three-hole punched on thick stock. And the salespeople really wanted that. It was really helpful because they could say, look, we're running an ad. We didn't have the ability to like show TV commercials easily like we do now on your phone, but those were really, really important. Just to jump a couple other things here, this is going to please everyone who has written a book on influencer marketing or anyone who's doing it. A lot of people are doing it wrong, but it really does work well, particularly in the B2B space, people don't realize. But you write about how a stamp of approval from another person is better than an ad. Well, okay. Well, everybody who's written a book about that has probably said the same thing. And earned media are customers acquired through word of mouth endorsements are more valuable and dependable than customers acquired through advertising. And earned media are worth their weight in gold. But the reason I was paying attention is because you had all this proof of that. Talk a little bit about how important that is.
Well, look, one of the things I want to say is when I was doing this research for the book, I wasn't just studying the data that we had. I was reading as many books and peer-reviewed journal research as I possibly could. And one of the greatest references out there was Dr. Hansen's Empirical Generalizations About Marketing Impact, where they take real-world studies and data, so not theoretical, but real-world data studies that have taken place, and they summarize, like, What were the findings and other things? And so I found that as an incredible resource backing up what we were actually trying to discover in the data as well. But fundamentally, it is just a truth that an advertisement raises a little bit of a red flag in a consumer of like, okay, can I trust what I'm hearing? Like they're just, they're selling me something.
Mm-hmm. It's an ad.
It's an ad. And unfortunately, influencer marketing over the last few years has shifted to feel a little bit more ad versus more natural as it used to be, but still has a tremendous impact and effect on influencing perceptions of a brand in a way that advertising struggles with because it's an ad. And so we saw a number of brands that clearly used an influencer marketing type strategy to get the word out about their products and gain traction. And those were more ones again, like Bang Energy Drink, really super successful in that regard. Or, in other cases of other people touting their horn, Health Aid Kombucha. When Cameron Diaz is a fan of your product and she's known as like the queen of kombucha, that's not going to hurt. And sometimes that's lucky in the case of kombucha, Health Aid that Cameron Diaz liked their product. In other cases like Body Armor, which took on Gatorade and Powerade, like from the very beginning, they sought out to get the backing and support of Kobe Bryant and James Harden and other famous athletes.
Well, I think you said they started with Mike Trout and some other folks. And then they worked their way up.
That's exactly it, and it made all the difference for them in terms of kind of other people touting their product who were liked and respected.
Yeah, I always wince a little bit when I see celebrity endorsements, just because I had dealt with some in the past that were a real problem.
I'm sure those can be a mixed bag, but yeah. Clearly Body Armor was successful with it. Nicorette was incredibly successful using Dale Earnhardt Jr. Quitting smoking campaign when they launched a new product, kind of flavored lozenges, and they leveraged Dale Earnhardt Jr. To talk about his experience trying to quit and how the product had helped him. It was incredibly impactful in the market.
Mm. Let's just talk one more time about innovation because this was so interesting. And I think that if brand marketers, brand managers were to spend a little more time on innovation activities, they're going to be more successful.
Yes, indeed.
This was maybe chapter 10, I think, but you're right that winners innovate and they do so by fundamentally improving the product experience for their customers. And it's almost like you snuck in a really, really good marketing psychology book here. I see what you did there, Jared. But you write, the secret to winning the innovation game lies in understanding what causes customers to make choices that help them achieve progress on something they are struggling with in their lives. And that companies should look at the frustrations that customers face and the workarounds that your customers need to do to get the full benefit of your products and achieving their goals. I mean, just each one of those was really almost entire books have been written about that have been
sure.
on the Marketing Book Podcast. But talk about this. It kind of goes back to jobs to be done, but this idea 100%. Of understanding what causes customers to make choices and help them achieve progress on something they're struggling with, and how best to go about that, because I think this is probably one of the maybe three biggest challenges for companies is just understanding their customers, talking to them.
I think that's exactly it. Look, one thing I want to say here, there were 58 winning brands out of the 25,000. 7 of them belong to Procter & Gamble.
Oh, that's okay? Right. Yeah.
Procter & Gamble is a behemoth, but they punched way above their weight. They had disproportionately more success than any other company out there in terms of the number and proportion of winning brands. And one of the techniques that they use is they really like to understand, for heavy users of a product or a category, or rejectors or others, they're basically trying to understand via interviews and studies where a product in the category, whether it's their own or a competitor's, is letting the consumer down. Like, why didn't you use it this time? Or why did you stop using that? Or why did you switch? Or what really frustrates you most about this product, other things? They're not focused on what you love about this product or that product. They are also focused on what could be better, what's not working, why are you switching, why did you quit using this, why don't you use it for this use case, why haven't you thought of it this way, and really picking apart the failure side of things or the issue side of things, and using that to guide whether it's enhancements to the product itself, most commonly to improve the usage experience. I mean, think about all the innovations that Procter & Gamble has brought in the laundry detergent category over the decades, powders to liquids to all the packaging and cap changes on the liquids to greater concentrated liquids to the pods, right? They were understanding the frustrations that consumers had using their product, and they just kept innovating and improving and improving and addressing those systematically over time. And those continued innovations have allowed them to create so many dominant brands in that category and, of course, in other categories as well.
Yes, but those Tide Pods are not as delicious as they used to be.
Not nearly. Not nearly.
Haters. So there's one book that was on the show a year or two ago by an author I'm very fond of named Nick Webb. And he's written a phenomenal book on innovation. And he's written books about, marketing and so forth. And he wrote this book called What Customers Hate. And it goes to what you were just talking about. It's just that one part he was saying, everyone should try to have a better experience for their customers, have a better experience with their products and so forth, just like we've been talking about. But he said, don't try and boil the ocean right off the bat, okay? Start with those 4 or 5 things that your customers hate.
Hate.
And, yes. And maybe it's just
about this product.
What do you hate about our product or our service? Or maybe more likely, what do you hate about our category? Like the taxi industry, Uber and Lyft, they must have asked that in the beginning, and it was pretty obvious what people hated. And they said that you get the most traction by focusing on what it is that people don't like. Oh, and he lives in Arizona. He's one of your homeboys.
No, all right. So Nicorette was one of our winning brands, and I had a chance to interview the brand manager for Nicorette to just get his take on, hey, what do you think it was that really triggered the successful growth of your brand, and especially against private label, because that's a challenge for so many brands, and they won directly against private label while private label lost, which is really rare. How'd they do it? And one of the things that he said is, look, in our category, the shopper consumer is intimidated by all the choices that are out there in terms of all the different form factors of gums and lozenges and patches and the different dosage levels and all these different things. And it's hard for them to figure out what is right for them. And also, if you put it behind, behind a counter and you have to ask a clerk and other things, it can get so frustrating, you're just going to walk away. And so one of their tactics was to create a structure at the shelf that guided consumers to the right solution for them. Were they looking to quit altogether? Were they looking to reduce their smoking? Were they, what was it that they were trying to do and achieve? And at what level, you know, how many packs a day they smoke, all these kind of things that basically helped easily guide the consumer to the right choice for them, whether it was Nicorette or a competitor or a private label. But by putting that kind of merchandising structure in place, they helped lead consumers to the right product for their needs. And by leading them to the right products for their needs, it more likely met their needs, which meant they were more likely to become repeat consumers.
Mm. Guided them. It was a Sherpa.
It was a stop smoking or Sherpa.
It's funny, whenever I hear about Nicorette, I always think of Barack Obama because I heard that that's what he smoked. And I was wondering, like, or didn't smoke. It's what he chewed because his wife was always yelling at him, don't stop smoking. And I guess the White House people said, you know, if you're going to smoke, go out on the balcony. But I always heard that that's what he used. And I thought, oh, maybe he was one of their, probably not a paid influencer. But anyway, well, listen, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you if you could just touch on the thing that you tie this all together with, which is the brand growth flywheel.
Certainly, certainly. So I have a systems engineering degree, and in that I learned a lot about system dynamics and just how to understand and measure and manage complex systems that have complex dynamics of feedback loops, reinforcing feedback loops, for example, or countering feedback loops, where these are nonlinear systems. You know, it's not just as simple as this causes that and this causes that, and that just explains everything. That is not what happens in the market at all. And so, through our study, we tested 39 different hypotheses to explain, you know, some of this, what we were seeing in terms of how brands grow. And these weren't our hypotheses. These are things you'd read in Byron Sharp's books or Philip Kotler's books or you know, hear from chief marketing officer of Procter & Gamble. And we put them to the test and we took those findings and we documented them. We said, well, this supposedly causes that and this supposedly causes that. And we just kind of laid them out. And then we figured out what was true based on data that we saw. And then we just took all these little kind of causal effects, these little causal arrows, and we started pointing them towards each other, you know, where we thought there was a causal effect. And so we got this total spaghetti scramble of, you know, the relationship between distribution and pricing and purchase occasions and other things. And we just started to try and organize what we were seeing in terms of the various causal relationships that were supported by the data. And as we did it, something that I now call the brand growth flywheel emerged. It emerged that at the center of everything was the product that you have and deliver. And around it was something that I ended up terming the repeat purchase loop, which is from the time you have a purchase occasion, the more purchase occasions you have, the more experience you have with the product. And if you have a positive experience consuming the product, then you're increasing the brand equity around the brand for that product. And if you're increasing the brand of equity, which is really, let's call it mental associations, if you want to use Byron Sharp's term, but sure. Basically, you know, where does this exist in your brain and what's it associated with? If you improve that and increase that wiring, then it means that you're going to be more attracted to that brand and its products going forward. You're going to be more likely to notice them on the shelf. You're going to be more likely to seek them out when you have that kind of need in the future. And of course, when you have that kind of need arise in the future, you are therefore more likely to select it and have another purchase occasion. And this repeat purchase loop kind of emerged by just understanding the causal forces. And of course, there are other forces at play here. And as we mapped them out, it created something called the brand growth flywheel, which became the structure by which we guide readers of this book on a journey to understand how these different factors, these different marketing levers can be pulled and adjusted and how they impact one another to increase momentum around the brand growth flywheel and build momentum for a brand through more and more repeat purchase behavior.
Yes, and it reminds me of how much it's like internal medicine. We'd like it to be really simple, like A, B,
wouldn't we?
C. Yeah. But it's it's not. There's a I'm sorry, folks.
The four P's aren't pillars. They're not pillars, right? No. These are levers that interact. It's like a soundboard at a concert,
yes.
Right? And you've got all these buttons and levers and knobs. And it's not like they act independently of one another, that if you move one, it's not going to affect something else. They have to be done in concert and secret if you want a quality sound and experience. And the same is true of marketing. Price and promotion and place and other things are not independent of each other. It is very important that they are controlled and those levers are pulled in harmony.
Yes, and we're not here to... We're not attacking those four P's. Those are still extremely valuable.
They're fundamental.
Yeah,
they're
they came about around 1960, and dang it, almost every week I see something on LinkedIn where somebody's, because marketers or keynoters love doing this, they talk about the four P's are dead, now it's the four Z's or whatever, or it's SEO is dead, or content is dead, or podcasting is dead, or Douglas Burdett is dead. So anyway, it gets tiresome. So the other thing I want to mention was that this complexity in your background, it's no surprise that there have been a number of authors of marketing and sales books on this podcast who have engineering backgrounds. I just think that training,
imagine that.
And the training works so well for modern marketing. Understanding a complex system and tweaking it, or understanding the connectedness.
Sure. And as we move from art to science, right, more and more we're going to continue to take things that were once purely art, and we are going to distill them to their fundamental principles, and we're going to be able to measure them and control for them and manage accordingly in a scientific manner as opposed to purely art. There will always be role for art within the science, but we do need to understand the core fundamental principles at play.
Yes, and two other things. One is your book is a hippo killer. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
A hippo is the highest paid person's opinion. So if you've ever been in a room or a business where basically you may have the data or but it's the highest paid opinion in the room is the one who rules. Well, this is a hippo killer, because I think a lot of people can say, well, boss, I'm not sure. let's start with the numbers here, or as they used to say on the sports reports, let's go to the videotape.
Well, I guess the bosses better read this first then.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine being a CEO and reading this? You'll never be BS'd by another marketer or
advertiser. In fact, I've been reached out to by a few CEOs who have read the book recently, and it's exactly what's happening.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. The other thing I want to mention is towards the end of the book, you talk about the funnel, which is still pervasive in marketing speak, particularly in the sales world, awareness, interest, desire, action, make up your own Glengarry, Glenn Ross joke.
Sure, yeah.
But it's like I've never seen such an eloquent obituary for the sales funnel as what you had at the end of this, where you're explaining, and you weren't even attacking it, but you were saying it's not that way. It's the repeat purchase, which is so central to all of your work. Quick question. Do you sense that there's going to be multiple editions of this in the future?
Well, we'll have to see. But I just address on the funnel. Look, I think the funnel makes a lot of sense for that first purchase. But if you're dealing in fast-moving consumer goods or products that are purchased even once a year, the vast, vast majority of all your sales will come from repeat purchases. And the funnel tends to stop and only explain up to that first purchase. And so you really have to understand the dynamics thereafter, which is what I think the brand growth flywheel does. And in terms of follow-on, I can tell you I'm already being asked by a lot of people outside of fast-moving consumer goods if I will adapt this for consumer services or just, any kind of brand at all. And so while I think there are a lot of insights that apply to any kind of brand beyond fast-moving consumer goods, I could see that the case studies aspect of this, of showing real-world case studies of how other types of brands have applied these principles to drive breakout growth, could be really useful.
Oh, that's great. And I ask about future editions because I'm full of ideas as long as I don't have to implement them. But it seems like you have this massive flywheel, no pun intended, of research now, where you can go back and update even this book every 2 or 3 years. It's like David Merriman Scott. He wrote The New Rules of Marketing and PR. It's on the 8th edition. And, he likes writing it, but I think a lot of people are saying, hey, what's the latest? What's going on? Yeah. You got to keep updating this. So I would think that it has a long shelf life. The challenge for you is deciding how you want to spend your time.
So sure, of course. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, Jared, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Oh, boy. I would say that winning brands win occasions, most in particular the usage occasion, but also that tends to lead to a particular type of purchase occasion. But basically, it's not just about selling more units. It's not just about reaching more households. Those are not what's most important. What's most important is winning brands win occasions. Understand the occasions that consumers have for consuming your type of product. Figure out the ones where you can best win and position yourself accordingly.
Well said. Well, other than reading chapter 12, which has the very specific 8 action items, what is one thing a listener could do today just to put a pencil to paper or put in action one of the many ideas from your book just to get them thinking in this direction, maybe while they're waiting for the book to arrive?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, while almost every marketer has done some kind of market segmentation on their type of customer, the question is, have they done that segmentation on usage occasions? Do they understand the proportion of usage of their product coming from different types of occasions? Who, what, when, where, why? The context of consumption. And then to go beyond that and say, what's our market share by each of those types of occasions? Are we winning and losing more or less than our fair share in those occasions? And what can we do about it?
Oh, great advice. Great advice. So looking back, Jared, what books have most inspired your work and career?
Oh, boy. So I would say in my career, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, I think has just been invaluable. You know, we're all working with people every day. And if you want to get things done, you've got to work with and through others. And I just think it offers so many valuable principles on that front.
Well, let me just add that book is almost 90 years old, 1936. And that book has been mentioned by so many authors.
Really? Yeah.
It's just amazing.
I believe it.
Yeah.
It's so impactful and it still holds today. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. I think, of course, Good to Great influenced the whole approach I took to the research in this book. But as I was doing the research for this book, Marketing to Mind States by Will Leach, who former PepsiCo marketer, I just found to be so spot on with so much of the research it pulled together coming out of neuroscience and cognitive psychology and other areas and making it applicable for brands in terms of how they position themselves. Really a fan of that one.
Yeah, he was on the Marketing Book podcast a few years ago. Just a fantastic book. And I should add, Will Leach, veteran of the United States Army.
Hoo-ah!
All right. You know, another book I liked fairly recently was The Elephant in the Brain by Hansen's, which I think really does a great job of taking all the latest bodies of work of what's happening really inside our brain based on all the latest research and helping us understand in terms of its implications in so many areas of anything from politics to business to marketing to personal life. Really impressive body of work.
Is that the same Hansen that was the doctor you mentioned?
Oh, that's a different one. Yes, that was Robin. This was Robin Hansen with The Elephant in the Brain, and the other was Dominic Hansen's. I think he's professor.
Or Robin Hansen,
UCLA.
I see.
Yeah, okay. And Dominic Hansen's wrote Empirical Generalizations About Marketing Impact, which is summarizing all of these real world, out in the field, real data studies of how marketing works, like, you know, different effects, anything from how do changes in online reviews impact sales, how do promotion effects build up over time, and how do they compare to advertising effects and how those build up over time. And just so many great insights so that you don't have to read 10,000 journal articles. He's done it for you and summarized the key findings from the different bits of research.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Dominic Hansen's, and it's on Amazon here. From 2009, I guess, Empirical Generalizations About Marketing Impact.
And there was an update in 2015 that I reference a lot in the book.
Oh, okay. Wow. Thanks for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. Well, super. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
You know, I'd love some good recommendations from you. I think the more recent one that I think relates to this field is The Elephant in the Brain, but I'd welcome recommendations.
Okay. Well, subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast. And so, well, listen, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned. You've got a special site for the book, as I recall.
And two, breakout-brands.com.
And your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account, all the things that are going to be helpful for folks to find. It's your episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now a word to you, dear listener. We're looking at you. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Jared and congratulate him on this book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or go to the site. Guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners. And Jared, not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking, but I have a feeling that Jared Schreiber is not going to, this isn't his last book, and now he's going to be deciding, because he's a data guy, he's going to go, okay, well, looking back, which podcast was I on where I seemed to get a good reaction? I hope he looks favorably upon this one. And if you're listening on your smartphone right now, and most everyone is, and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast or your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Jared Schreiber, you don't get away without me quoting one more time from the book. You write, "While this book is based on scientific research, it is not a science textbook. It is not simply a book of theories or a history of marketing science. Such books have their place, but they are rarely practical. My goal with Breakout Brands is to give you a pragmatic field guide that shows through data-backed examples, the tactical mechanics by which brands grow year over year. By the end of this book, you should better understand the levers you can pull and how those levers work together to help you increase revenue and gain more market share. This book reveals how to engineer brand growth. It is informed by peer-reviewed research, but moves beyond the science to show you what you can do with the empirical evidence, how to take simple, rational and down-to-earth steps to grow a brand year after year sustainably. As a brand manager, you are like a sound engineer in a music studio. You need to know how all the knobs and levers on the soundboard interact with each other. None stand alone. If you want lush, pleasing results, like you hear on the Marketing Book Podcast," okay, I just added that, "you must adjust the various levers to balance the instruments for maximal effect. You have to know how everything fits and works together. By reading Breakout Brands, I want you to leave with a real sense of the key factors and how they combine to drive brand growth. The book is Breakout Brands, Why Some Brands Take Off and Others Don't. The author is Jared Schreiber. Jared, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.